We have a moment where all of you who are a little younger, parents who want your little younger ones out of the sanctuary because of our topic today, we're going to take a moment to do that. Pastor Bev is over here on this side of the sanctuary, and if you're a tiny one, if you're an older one, you don't get to leave now. But if you're a tiny one, you get to leave now. Pastor Bev's taking you to the lower level in the kindergarten room. Follow her. It'll be more fun. And we take a minute to do that because our topic today, hashtag Me Too. Oh, as soon as I said hashtag Me Too, they started running. You heard me, parents? We'll see you in about 5 years. If you're visiting La Sierra today, welcome, and we want you to know something. We are not attempting to be provocative, edgy, difficult. When the students said to us, the whole world is talking about Me Too, surely the church has something to say. We have to answer that. So today, it's not provocative, edgy, difficult, church. It is an attempt to be faithful to the conversation. Even so, we get that a whole lot of us would like to just go ahead and leave now. So to help us be comfortable, we're going to take a little help from Saturday Night Live. We're going to give them a couple minutes to help us.
You know, what's insane are these roasted carrots. They are so good.
Oh, everything here is good. The New York Times restaurant review raved about this place.
You know, speaking of the Times, did any of you guys read that op-ed piece about...
Honey, no.
What article are you talking about?
The one about Aziz Ansari? We can talk about it. It's something else. I was just curious what everyone thought. But.
No, of course. We can talk about it. Yeah, I mean, I think we should.
We absolutely should.
Well, it's come to this. I'll go first.
Are you sure you want to do this?
Yes, I will speak on the topic of Aziz Ansari. I think...
Careful.
Yeah, I think that some women, careful, or rather, some men have a proclivity.
Careful.
Help me.
Okay, sure. Well, while I applaud the movement.
Watch it.
Noted. It's just that I wonder if maybe we're setting it back.
Careful. Okay. I feel that powerful men almost always abuse. Nope!
Okay. Look. The thing that I keep going back to is it seems like if she wanted to leave.
Oh, no.
She could have just...
Oh, no.
...left.
Stop. We can talk about this. We are adults.
Okay, fine. The Me Too movement, pass.
Okay, consent, pass.
Okay, if I were with a woman and she seemed at all uneasy, I would just slow my rolls are good.
Okay, what I think we're forgetting...
Oh, no.
...is the way that this intersects with the issue of race.
No!
So good, right? Want to go home now? We can talk about it, right? We can talk about it, right? See, here's the truth. We can hardly turn many pages in our sacred text before we encounter a story that probably qualifies for the Me Too movement. That movement, which began in October, this incarnation of it, began in October with many allegations against Harvey Weinstein, the owner, executive at the Weinstein Group, producing up to as many as 30 films a year. Multiple allegations, and the women, employees, and actresses were told over the years as they submitted their complaints, they were told by HR people and others, supervisors, friends, insiders, you don't really want to cause this problem, do you? You know everybody has to pay their dues. You know you're not the first one. Weinstein himself, protected by his own insiders, reporters, and Hollywood friends, Weinstein himself was known to say to women, one phone call and you're done. Do you know who I know in this town? I know the president. Who do you know? Dozens, hundreds of women now. It turns out one young employee summarized it this way a year or so ago, 28 years old, and she says, I'm a 28-year-old woman trying to make a living and a career. She's writing to executives at the Weinstein Group. He's a 64-year-old world-famous man, and this is his company. From where I stand, the power balance is me zero, Harvey Weinstein 10. As you know, unless you've been sleeping under rocks, Harvey Weinstein resigned in October. So did four from his board of directors, and the floodgates opened. It was actress Alyssa Milano taking to Twitter who invited her followers, if you resonate with what's happening with the Weinstein Group, send me a tweet, hashtag MeToo. Within 24 hours, 500,000 women said MeToo. Turns out Me Too is actually coined about 20 years earlier by a different woman, Tanya Burke, with a different story. This was the beginning in October of the movement we referenced today. So I think Bathsheba in our Bible story qualifies as a Me Too woman. 2 Samuel chapter 11 reads like this, verse 1, in the spring, at the time when kings go off to war, David sent Joab out with the king's men and the whole Israelite army. They destroyed the Ammonites, they besieged Rabbah, and David remained in Jerusalem. David is the king. One evening, David got up from his bed. He walked around the roof of the palace. From the roof, he saw a woman bathing in the distance. She was very beautiful. David sent someone to find out about her, and the man came back and said to him, "Isn't that Bathsheba? She's married. She's got a husband. His name is Uriah." David sent a messenger. King David sent a messenger. Bathsheba, sitting in her bath chambers, gets a message from the king. Come now. And I can hear the Weinstein voice echoing. Do you know who I am? I know your grandfather and your father and your uncles, Bathsheba. Did you know that? That I know your family? You really think you want to say no? Do you want to be the girl everyone talks about, Bathsheba? So she goes. The Bible is brief when it reports the encounter. 2 Samuel 11, verse 4 says, he slept with her. The Bible's equally brief in summarizing the outcome. I am pregnant. Now the king, King David, begins frantically working to cover up what he had uncovered. He needs Bathsheba's husband home, so he sends Bathsheba's husband. Uriah is out fighting. He sends word, bring Uriah home. Uriah comes home. The story unfolds that the king, you know, Uriah, tell me how it's going on the war, the battlefront. How's it out there? And hey, he needs some excuse to get Uriah back home. I'll tell you what, take the night off, go home, eat and drink and be with your wife. Have a good evening. Bible says that this is what happened. The king said to Uriah, go down to your house and wash your feet. You can't tell that that's go have sex with your wife. That's code for go do it. He doesn't. He can't take his mind off of the war, so it turns out that he lays down, sleeps out in the field with all the other soldiers. The king wakes up the next morning with a bigger problem, and you can hear the anxiety building. The king needs Uriah to go home and sleep with his wife because he needs another paternity option. So the king says, take a few more days off, Uriah. I'll tell you what, let's have a party. Let's drink some wine. Let's eat and drink some more. Surely he'll go home now tonight. Go home and enjoy your wife. But it turns out Uriah drops tired, curls up in a mat with all the other men at the king's palace. This is not good news for the king. So the king goes to option number three. I guess I'll kill him. Because kings can do that. If you provoke them, if you, you know, disobey them, or if you happen to be the husband of the woman who's pregnant with the king's baby. So the king sends Uriah back out to the battle. Uriah doesn't know the papers he's carrying in his arms are the death orders, his own death orders. When he gets back to the battlefield, the captain in the army sends Uriah right out to the front lines, and he's dead. Killed by the enemy. It's a very sad war tragedy. Word comes back to Bathsheba. 2 Samuel 11, verse 26. When Uriah's wife heard that her husband was dead, she mourned for him. After the time of mourning was over, David had her brought to his house, and she became his wife, and she bore him a son. The story gets this tagline at the end, but the thing David had done displeased the Lord. I have a question. I would like to know the thing that displeased the Lord. What's the thing? Is it looking at Bathsheba naked bathing over there? Is it coveting Bathsheba? That breaks a commandment. Is it taking her and having sex with her? That's adultery. That's another commandment. Is it abusing imperial power that displeases the Lord? Is it that David could not possibly be a man after God and also a man after Bathsheba? Is it the web of fractured relationships that David has now just unleashed? What exactly is it that displeases the Lord? It's a question I have of the story. So the traditional way that the story gets told, there's a couple of summaries. By the way, we recited Psalm 51 3 weeks ago here. That's the psalm when David cries out to God after, supposedly, after the Bathsheba incident. God, only against you have I committed sin. Really? Really? Story of David and Bathsheba gets interpreted a couple of different ways in Christian tradition. The first, David, don't stay home. Don't take time off work. Go to work. Stay busy. Idle hands are... Yeah, some of you who are older, what is it? Idle hands or what? Trouble. I heard several translations. The devil's playground, the devil's workshop. Idle hands belong to the devil. You'll get in trouble. David, stay busy, especially stay busy doing the Lord's work. David should have stayed occupied. Another interpretation of the story, Bathsheba, what are you doing being beautiful? Stop. How inconsiderate of you. One commentator summarizes this way, Bathsheba is the woman whose beauty caused lust, adultery, and murder. She's beautiful. She exposed herself. What is she doing bathing nude? Because you bathe with your clothes on. Christian tradition now. What is she doing bathing nude, being beautiful, provoking the king? Shame on you, Bathsheba. You brought this on. You brought the demise of the king. You could have said no when he summons you to the bedchamber. Say no. When he forces himself upon you, say no. You are complicit. You're an accomplice in this story. Shame on Bathsheba. That is another traditional interpretation of the David and Bathsheba story, friends. So there's a life lesson in 2 Samuel chapter 11. Don't be like David and Bathsheba. This is what we most often teach, and then we turn the page in the story because here's the truth. Which of us are going to be summoned to the king's bedchamber tonight? Which of you men will be sent off to the front lines in Syria because your rival doesn't like you? Because the details of our story are different and time and culture and space are different. Okay, we won't be like David and Bathsheba, and we turn the page on the story. But I want to press the story a little further because David and Bathsheba belong to God and God's story. So there's something to be said here about God's story. The Bible here, it's nothing if it's not at least a weeping witness of traumatic relationships and oftentimes traumatic sexual relationships. In the Seventh-day Adventist Church, we do have something to say about this. We promised at the beginning of this sermon series, in this skin, we promised that when the church had something to say that addressed some of these topics, we would name it. Well, the church has a doctrine, a statement on what it means to be human, the nature of humanity, fundamental belief number 7. We'll only give you a few sentences. It's printed in its entirety on the walls of the sanctuary here. We ought to read it. This is the one of the 28 ideas Adventists say are important. Man and woman are created in the image of God with individuality, with power and freedom to think and do. Though created free beings, each is an indivisible unity of body, mind, and spirit, dependent upon God for life and breath and all else. In the image of God, all of us created, all of us freedom of agency and movement in God's story. The belief goes on to say, and then Genesis chapter 3, and then the image of God in us is marred. We realize that there are weak tendencies, evil tendencies, choices for evil that come to the human family. But then there is Jesus and redemption and restoration today, even today. The fundamental belief ends by saying, so take care of each other, the humanity in one another. It's really quite beautiful. Turns out we do have something to say about what it is to be human in God's world, fundamental belief number 7. But can I push a little bit deeper, church? Are you okay? Everybody okay? Yes. Good. It helps if you answer back. Are you okay? Yes. Think of it like you're in the dentist chair and I'm going in for the extraction now. Oh, no, let's make it happy. All right, I want to push a little deeper. That's the beautiful statement the church makes on what it is to be human. But I think that there is something more, the traditional readings of the story, our Bible stories in the Christian church, and that something more contributes to what we experience in culture today, because while the hashtag, the Me Too movement, is contemporary, it's not altogether new. Something in Christian tradition, I believe, contributes to what we experience. Here's a little more in the story. Bathsheba, for example, is a possession. In 27 verses, she speaks one time, I am pregnant, is her big line. In 27 verses, her name is used once. Bathsheba is a possession. She's actually caught up in a grander, greater tale of kingship and imperial authority and what the men are up to. It turns out Bathsheba does not have ability to operate her own freedom of conscience, her own choices, her own consent. She's just trying to stay alive. If we press the story, it has a little bit more to say. Is this the thing that displeased God, I wonder? That when David forces himself on Bathsheba, he actually takes away Bathsheba's agency to act as a free human being in the world. This is the heart of the Me Too movement, friends, this ignoring consent, personal agency, freedom of conscience. And this is how we end up with harassment and abuse, and in the most egregious cases, violence, and eventually rape. I want to press just a little further in the few minutes that we have left, because the Me Too movement gave birth to other movements, and you've read about them in the news, perhaps. Church 2 is one of them that I would like to name. Church 2, it was just a month after Me Too that a Christian woman watching the Me Too movement said, but wait, this also happens inside the church. Inside the church, we're living with violence on women's bodies, women who aren't able to exercise their consent, their free personal agency. Her name is Hannah Pash. She goes to social media, the same thing. If you're a Christian and this has happened to you in church, could you just send me a little message? Church too. Turns out hundreds and thousands of women, some Christians, some formerly Christians, some now atheists and agnostics, many, many, many people responded, gave her their message. And their primary concern is, but we're taught to be silent because we don't know if we can be heard. We don't know if we'll be safe. We don't know if we'll be surrounded or excommunicated because look, most of them leading us are men. And are we supposed to tell them this happened to us? Church two, perhaps the person who has the most exposure on this topic, her face will look familiar to you, Rachel Denhollander. On the walls in the sanctuary is an article from Christianity Today that chronicles some of her experience. Do you recognize her face from the United States gymnastic team? She was the first to come forward and make the accusation against the physician, the team doctor, Larry Nassar. She was the last to give testimony in the courtroom last month, the last one to look at him and give voice to the way he victimized her. It turns out when she stepped forward to talk about what was happening with the U.S. gymnastics team, she felt support from that group of people. But when she stepped out to become advocates for people in her faith community who were also suffering, that's when it got ugly. When she stepped out to advocate for young women who were being abused by leaders in the church, this is when she lost her friends. This is when people began to go on to the attack. This is when people told her she was just sensationalistic, that she was full of rage, that how could she as a child of God? It turns out the headline for her story is, hey, she did a really big thing for the U.S. gymnastics team, and she lost her church. In the meantime, when she's asked what she would say to the Christian community, Rachel, who is now an attorney, she says, "The first thing I would say to Christians is the gospel of Jesus Christ does not need your protection. It defies the gospel of Christ when we do not call out abuse and when we enable abuse in the church. Jesus doesn't need your protection. He needs your obedience," she says. So, Me Too, Church Too movement, this has become one of their mottos, silence is not spirituality. The Me Too movement, the Church Too movement, you know that it spawned many other movements now, many industries who are exploring and cleaning house and have unleashed new policies and practices and are working on it. You know that when the United States Olympic Committee held their first press conference on Friday, yesterday, in South Korea, the very first words out of their mouth, "We apologize to the women of the United States gymnastic team." To over 250 women. Now they're learning. There are several, if not a dozen or more, coaches and helpers and physicians and supervisors who had rumor of this. Oh yes, something is going on in our world. Some synergy and combination of conversations. I believe the Christian church has participated, and I want to name it very carefully this afternoon. As early as the second century, Jesus has been gone for just a little while, and as early as the second century, Christian thinkers, theologians began to reflect on what it is to be human, men and women. Tertullian is one in the second century who says this about women. "Do you not know that each of you women, you're as Eve? Do you not know that the sentence of God on your lives for this age, it's guilt? You must necessarily live with guilt. You women are the gate of hell." By the fourth century, John Chrysostom is saying, "Among all the savage beasts, none is found so harmful as women." This is in our thinking and our talking and our preaching and our teaching and our shaping of our gospel and our church from the very first ages. So in order to make any progress today, we'll have to step over. We'll have to move with that Christian history in mind. We'll have to move with shame and guilt and frustration and great apology. Church, we'll have to move. I cannot say everything I'd like to say today on this topic. I hope I can say something helpful when I say this. When the Christian church has conveyed the message to women and girls that it was about the sex, that somehow if something happened to them, some abuser, that it was about the sex and they are now impure in the sight of God. If we somehow conveyed it was about the sex rather than the assault on your free agency, your freedom of conscience, your ability to act and move and be, if we made it about the sex, we said the wrong thing. And I apologize for that. So it turns out that it is about personal agency and power and consent, and sexuality has been the vehicle. When we made it about purity, can you imagine how many thousands and thousands of young girls have become women who've wandered through their lives thinking that they have disappointed God because they were violated? We can change that narrative. We can do better. Faith communities have to. We have to. We have to stop shaming people. We have to stop making this sexist. This is just what boys do. This is just what men do. Oh, no, it's not. It's not what most of you men do. It's not what any of the men do that I know and love. This is just what girls have to go through. Oh, no, it's not. Church, we can change that narrative. This is the reason to talk about it today. To be faithful to it, to identify it when we see this happening, when we see shaming and sexism. I want to show you a couple of pictures. The first is one of the talent groups that worked with the Weinstein Company. The picture of this group of gentlemen published in the New York Times, they managed talent for the Weinstein Group. This would be some of the men that the women would go and report to over the years when they came up against harassment or sexual assault. These were the guys that they reported to. Can I show you another group? This is a group of evangelical leaders, preachers. They're gathering for a pastor's conference, a large one in the South during the month of April. Listed here is one of the men, one of the preacher leaders that Rachel, the Rachel story with her Christian community, one of the men accused of wrongdoing. Do you notice what these pictures have in common, right? I want to show you a picture of the church that we love, Seventh-day Adventist Church in Portugal this week, in global leadership meetings. I can find one woman around the table. We can do something about this. You all can do something about this. You can change every single circle that you are a part of. Every time they send you to a committee to vote on something, ask where the female candidates are. Every time they send you somewhere to represent and you look around the room and there's no diversity, ask and demand that it looked different. This is how we change the story and the narrative and the experience, friends. The response to the criticism to the Me Too movement has been heavy. The pushback has been heavy. I understand that some of it has come from men. When we sat with the students who asked us to please address this topic, in the mix of students, there was one student who said, I'm not necessarily the Me Too movement, but I identify with what we're talking about. Because when I was a younger boy, I was raped, and I walked around in shame for a lot of years, and I walked around wondering if I could actually be a man and a man of God. It's taken me a lot of work. Yes, men, there are many men listening or here today for whom you can identify with the Me Too movement. While we're not talking about that today, we note that today. We also know that there have been many men who, in response to Me Too and Church Too, have started additional movements like I Did That. Hashtag I Did That. For every Me Too, there's someone who's posting, I did that. I did that when I was younger. I did that to a woman. I did that in the workplace, and I'm sorry. Or another hashtag, I have harassed women, or I have witnessed it happening and I didn't stop. I have participated by not getting involved. And there's another hashtag, I will. I will commit to something other in the future. I will, when I see harassment happening, I will step in. I will, when I see women name-called, degraded, sidelined, I will step in. There's been a beautiful, beautiful swell of men. Thank you, men of this congregation, for the way you're using your voices too. It's beautiful. This Seventh-day Adventist church has said something. I want to read to you, and it's a little bit lengthy, but I think it's worth it. In addition to the doctrine that we read, this is a statement from 2009, 2010, and it turns out on the walls of the sanctuary, you'll read a few more that sound like this. We've said a lot about the violence against children, women, and girls. Here's one statement. We, the members of the Seventh-day Adventist Church, we speak up and we join with others. We want to bring an end to violence against women and girls. Global statistics indicate that in all societies, women and girls are more frequently the victims of violence, actions, or threats likely to result in physical, sexual, or psychological harm or suffering are incompatible with the biblical ethics and Christian morality. Such actions include, but are not limited to, family violence, rape, female genital mutilation, honor killings, dowry murders, manipulation, denial of personal liberty, coercion. These are also acts of abuse and violence. To such behaviors, the Seventh-day Adventist Church says, let's end it now. Seventh-day Adventists recognize that the creation in God's image bestows dignity and worth on every individual. Christ-like behavior leaves no room for violence against family members or persons outside the family. Seventh-day Adventists commit themselves to being leaders in breaking the cycle of violence perpetrated against women and girls. We will speak. We'll speak out in defense of victims and survivors through teaching and preaching, through Bible study and advocacy, the collective voice of many save tens and thousands of women and girls from harm and suffering that result from abuse and violence. And that's your church. It's beautiful. It's beautiful. End it now is the campaign. Every year it passes through local congregations. It turns out there are many things we can do towards the future. We can teach our boys, our little boys, that women are brave and strong, but they're also vulnerable in their bodies in ways that boys are not. We can teach our girls that they are brave and strong and that their problem is not their womanhood, but it is in the world. We can teach our boys and girls to love one another, that the world is better when boys take care of girls and girls take care of boys. Isn't that beautiful? The world is better. We can do much. Look at this video from a nonprofit group in the United Kingdom towards doing better.
This afternoon, we're going to draw people doing different jobs. And the first job we're going to draw is a firefighter.
Have a think in your head what a firefighter looks like.
What are we doing?
What's your firefighter called?
Mine's called Firefighter Gary.
Firefighter Stan.
Firefighter Simon.
He's big and strong.
He's got a big helmet on.
That's brilliant, isn't it?
Next, we're going to draw a surgeon.
Have you thought of a name for your surgeon?
Jim Bob.
Jim Bob.
He's a brain surgeon.
I think he would wear a stethoscope.
He gives you medicine.
That's his ambulance.
Okay, next, we're going to draw a fighter pilot. Yes.
This is his jet plane.
He rescues people.
He likes to do stunts in the air and stuff.
Okay, now, who would like to meet these people for real?
Yeah!
And they're dressed up.
My name's Tamsin and I'm a surgeon in the NHS.
My name's Lauren, and I'm a pilot in the Royal Air Force.
My name's Lucy. I'm a firefighter in the London Fire Brigade.
So who wants to know how to do an operation?
Who's putting it on?
I'm trying my stethoscope.
We put this in here.
What does it look like?
There you go. Now you're a proper fighter pilot.
So into your ears. Can you hear that?
Yeah.
It's really good. It's much better, yeah, it's much better than the kids' one.
Isn't that lovely? Isn't that beautiful? So, so beautiful. There is so much potential. As you think about this today and as we prepare to leave this place, please remember none of us are alone in our brokenness. No lonely, broken people. When we had 2009, the Women's Resource Center asked us to think and talk about sexuality. On that Sabbath in 2009, this was painted by our artist, Beatrice Krumbine. You'll see images up here of her working on it during the Sabbath services. She worked and worked and worked, and it was only towards the end of our time together that she sewed Bathsheba's mouth closed. Because in the biblical story, Bathsheba hardly speaks. And we've learned that silence never pays. It will be David and Bathsheba's son who will go on to rape his sister. And the stories will go on and on. Look what happened as Beatrice added a little more white paint to the cheeks. Look what happened as the water began to move down the cheeks of Bathsheba. And Beatrice began to attend to her as if to say, don't cry. Beatrice said after church that day, I couldn't have planned that. Bathsheba, weeping. No one is alone in their brokenness today, friends. Bathsheba has sisters, is what I'm saying. Bathsheba has many sisters. One of them is Tamar. Tamar said no. Tamar didn't have a choice. It didn't happen in a deserted alley or in a car dark at night. For Tamar, it happened at home, and her perpetrators were her family members. Bathsheba has a sister named Tamar. Tamar has a sister. Her name is Rahab. Rahab, we've heard of her from the Bible. We think she chose her profession to be a prostitute in the king's service. We think she chose to live in the walls of Jericho night and day, day and night, and service the traveling men who came through gathering intel for the king. Rahab has a sister. She's the unnamed, silent woman from Judges chapter 19. Oh, they call her a concubine. Yeah, this one. They threw her out like a piece of meat to a pack of men late at night who tortured her, raped her all night long, and when the sun rose, she crawled on her hands and knees to try to escape. The concubine of Judges 19 has a sister. These sisters are recorded in the book of Exodus, the book of Numbers, chapter 31. They number 32,000 women. These are the Midianite women who are captured by Moses and Moses' soldiers. Well, these are just the virgins. 32,000 virgins means young girls. Half of them are given to Moses and his men, and the other half of them are given to the men of Israel for their own pleasure. It turns out Bathsheba has many sisters, doesn't she? Some of you came here today with that same pain and that same brokenness, and some of you grew up in an era and in a church that did not allow you to speak. But if the Me Too movement, if the vulnerability and the solidarity of the moment are meaningful to you. We ask you to rise today in community here. Stand up if you identify with the Me Too pain and trauma. Stand up and look around. To the brokenness that remains, can I say to you, there are many ways to get to God's future. This is not what any of us planned for our lives. But can I tell you, when Jesus is born into this world, the Gospel of Matthew says he's born into a family, turns out to be Bathsheba's family, that Bathsheba is good enough for Jesus. So let none of you leave today brokenhearted and unresolved. Shame is not your story. Guilt can be our teacher, and healing is available.